Why is it we humans get romanced by complexity when the answers can be found at a simple and practical level? This is the Simply Practically Human podcast, where the human manager, Mark Labasque, features experts who have a track record in humanizing workplaces, using simplicity and practicality as their go-to approach. It's all about getting back to what it is to be human and watch workplaces thrive rather than just survive.
Hey there, it's Mark Labasque for the Simply Practically Human podcast, and I was delighted to be joined in this episode by Alexis Nikki, who is based in Paris in France, but as she'll share with you, works in the space of narrative intelligence as a narrative coach facilitator and also as a workshop designer, helping human beings at individual level and at group level and organizational level to step into their narrative and to start to embrace this idea of narrative intelligence and understanding the power of story and how story can connect humans and to energize them to do not just great work in organizations, but to get a greater sense of self and to understand more about themselves and the power of, I guess, this idea that she speaks about of working somewhere between hope and fear. So she'll talk about that a bit today. I got to meet Alexis maybe about 2 or 3 months ago now on a session that we get involved with, and she actually ran a session for 2 hours on narrative intelligence, and I was just really captivated by the nature of the way that she powerfully shares how story can be something that can help you as a manager or just as a human being to let other people to connect with you. So she'll talk a lot about that today. She'll share some pretty cool tips around what managers can do. And the one I really like the most, without giving too much away, is the little secret that this work starts itself, which is something that I always, for those who know and who work with me or know my work, will know that it all starts with self before you can start to help others. So I love the fact that we went there. We talked about a few other things around, you know, story is not competition. How do you help people that are a little bit over-exuberant about getting everyone to share their stories, maybe just to tone it down a bit and meet people where they're at? I'm sure you're going to enjoy this. Again, you're going to get some great tools and tips. So get that pen and paper out, sit back, grab yourself a drink, have a listen, and we'll catch you at the end. I'm delighted to be joined today by Alexis Nikki, who's a narrative coach, facilitator, and workshop designer. Alexis, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's really fun to be here.
Hey, we met through this thing called Drinking Dialogues, and I got to tell this story that I reached out to you a couple of weeks ago, I think, to see if you'd come onto the podcast. And at the time, you were...
I was listening to one of your podcasts, yeah. I've listened to several, so actually right now I'm not remembering which episode it was.
Oh, I'm pleased to hear that people are listening. It was sort of spooky at the time, but I've really enjoyed getting to know you in the breakout groups and in those sessions, and particularly with the session that you ran in Drinking Dialogues. And I wanted to get you to share some of your expertise and experience and knowledge around this topic of narrative intelligence. So just before we get into that, maybe just share a little bit about your backstory. I like to add a human element into what we're doing so the listeners get to know a bit more about you as the person.
Sure. And there's a lot to my backstory. There are several strands because I haven't had a linear life. And to get to the work that I'm doing today, all the paths that I took led me here. So I'm going to try to briefly cover them all. And I think one of the first and most important things is the fact that I am an American, but I've lived in Europe most of my life. And I've moved a lot between 3 different European countries and the US, a total of 4 countries, but it was back and forth. So, you know, 3 times in Germany, 3 times in France, multiple times in the States, a couple of times in Greece. And that started when I was very young. My father was a pilot and we just moved a lot. And I have a Greek background. So I had that dual culture. And I was always changing cultures and navigating languages. And all of that helped me feel a little bit, you know, seeking who I was and where I belonged. And through all of that, I always went to English language schools, and English became the through line. And I discovered writing and journaling and trying to figure out my story through writing. And that was like my first important strand. Another strand is that as a child, I lived in Athens, and my father was a great storyteller. And we'd stand on our balcony And we'd look out across the way to the Acropolis. We could see the Acropolis from our apartment. And he would tell me the stories of the myths of the gods and of Athena, especially. And I, as a kid, I would imagine her flying through the sky on her way home after her day's adventures and like going home over there to go to sleep. And she was a patron goddess of the city. I felt she was my personal patron goddess living right over there. And I knew she was a myth, but at the same time, there was this piece of that felt so real to me.
Yeah.
So I felt like I grew up in a story world. And then later I lived in Cold War Berlin, which was like another kind of a story world. And so those things really had an impact on me. And then later in my 20s, I trained as a teacher of the Alexander Technique, which is a technique, I know you know because you're Australian, but it's a technique that really helps you become more aware of your physical and your mental habits.
Yes.
And we, you know, we talk about the unity of body and mind, but with the Alexander Technique, you really experience the reality of that. And it, you rediscover your natural freedom and you kind of close gaps. You close gaps between what you think you're doing, what you're actually doing, and between who you think you should be and who you actually are. You become more coherent. You clarify your story. So I worked with students for about 20 years, and at the same time, I continued writing, and I had started translating and subtitling for film and television when I was living in Germany. And from there, I segued into screenwriting and then screen consulting, sort of script consulting, working with European writers to help them improve their stories. And as I was doing those things, two things together, teaching Alexander Technique and screenwriting, I began to notice I'm doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm helping people close those gaps. I'm helping people, you know, stop chasing what they think they should write, should the story they think they should tell, the person they think they should be, and sort of get more in contact with who they are, what the story it is that they want to tell. And so, you know, when I saw that, I was like, whoa, at the heart of my entire life has been this idea of story as a way to make us more coherent, as the tool that we use to understand ourselves.
Yeah, I love it. So you're now based, are you in Paris now, is that right?
I am in Paris now, yeah.
Yeah, oh,
I'm
lovely.
In France, yeah.
And you've got your business there. So in that business, you've got that sort of narrative coach, the facilitation and the workshop design. Do you want to just share a little bit about what you do in that space?
What I do as a consultant, yeah, or a coach or a facilitator, whatever I call myself on any given day, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, one's own story is always the hardest one to tell. but what I do is, first of all, I have a conversation with the client to see what their needs are.
Yep.
And if I feel I can help, I begin to explain to them maybe how I can help. And what I do is I can go in and work with a team that might not be working well together or might have a problem they need to solve, but where there is some narrative in the background that's kind of blocking an advancement in that direction. And it can simply be because each person thinks something different, but they haven't had conversations together to figure out where everybody is on the issue. So sometimes it's just a matter of my getting the group together, letting them talk about their lived experiences, and that raises, that helps them figure out how to solve the problem. And other times it's really because there is a narrative that needs to change, or a new habit that needs to be instilled in a group or a team, or I do one-on-one coaching with leaders or individuals. And for, you know, for me, it always distills back to story. And sometimes the story, sometimes I help people put together a presentation or, you know, structure a speech. That happens as well. So there's always an element of story. Sometimes it's really upfront. And other times it's not me teaching story skills, but it's facilitating an exchange of stories.
I love it. So many different strings to the bow. And I love your stories about how when you reflect back on your earlier years, that story was always there. And it's interesting how the cycle happens. And now this is what you do. This is what you get to do day to day in helping other people. I love what you said too. I'm going to come back to this thing. It's telling and understanding our own story is always the hardest. I think that's a really interesting point. When you presented at the Drinking Dialogues, you were talking about narrative intelligence. And I was like, wow, I wonder what that actually means. So would you mind just sharing what is narrative intelligence?
Yeah, it's a term that I've hesitated to use because I don't want to put it out there like, you know, emotional intelligence and this kind of intelligence and that kind of intelligence. But again, it's always been in the background of the work that I've done. Mm. So there is one definition of narrative intelligence that has to do with contrast to artificial intelligence. You know, as machine learning increases and algorithms are trying to learn how to tell narratives the way humans do, that's one area of how that term is being used. But I'm just going to talk about it the way I understand it, which is as a natural human capacity that we all have. And I'm not the first person to apply narrative intelligence to organizations working within organizations. I first learned about it from Steve Denning. I know also Carol Pearson talks about it a lot and many others. But, you know, for me, it's really about being aware of the power of story and of how important it is to us as human beings and to its pervasiveness in our lives. So they really, stories do shape our lives, our businesses, our societies. I mean, think back to the story I told about Athena, the myth that an entire civilization built a temple to. And not just her, many of the gods had their temples all over the ancient world. Our stories really, really do. They're vital to us and they're powerful. And we need to become conscious of that power. And we're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that because, you know, I think about the human stuff and this idea of that we're a social species, we're a social creature that wants to connect. And I'm just interested then in your thoughts around how story has been pivotal in connecting human beings.
It's been absolutely vital because what story does is it doesn't just speak to our minds, it speaks to our hearts. And, you know, we're not just exchanging information when we tell a story, we're showing something of ourselves. We're letting people into who we are. And we're letting people into our hopes and our fears, which is another aspect for me of narrative intelligence. It's really becoming aware that we are creatures of hope and fear, you know, and that our stories are about our hopes and fears.
Hmm. Let's put an organizational or business lens on this now. So it's the story is sort of giving something more of you. And I guess over many, many years of being in business, it was more about, it wasn't such a story of you, it was a story of what you achieved. And these are the numbers and here's what things are. What do you think's helped organizations to shift more into this space of understanding the importance of managers or anyone telling story to use story to create a message that people believe, understand more? What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think there are a lot of different things, and I'm not sure that every organization has actually made that shift yet.
Yeah.
Or if they've made that shift, they've misunderstood what it means. So because story can also be used as a bludgeon and a weapon and to try to force people to conform.
Yes.
But there are some organizations who are beginning to understand the importance of, you know, more authentic storytelling. Because what you described, here are the numbers, here are the results. For me, that's a sort of a story shield. Like, here's my story, you know, but I'm like behind it, right? I'm kind of hiding away behind it. And creating a message, that's something that I kind of always react a bit badly to, the idea of creating a message, because I hear in that because I want somebody else to do something. Story is invitational, sort of authentic storytelling is invitational. It invites the person to step into it. It invites the person to see themselves in it and to decide that they want to participate in that story. And that takes skill and narrative. That's where narrative intelligence becomes really important. We can be stupid about story and create all sorts of messages and kind of bash each other about the head with them. We see that all the time, right? Mm. That's, you know, narrative stupidity in my view, right? Narrative intelligence is really understanding, like, you know, we've got tender hearts and minds in our hands here, and we need to, you know, again, going back to this, we are creatures of hope and fear, and this is what stories are really good for. They can talk about our fears in a way that people can say, kind of relax and say, oh, yeah, I feel that too. And then we can move people toward a more hopeful stance because we've acknowledged their fears and our own fears and the situation that we're in. And it is really hard. And, you know, COVID's not going to disappear overnight. And, you know, whatever the case may be. And yet we need to move forward. And yet we need to aim for a better future. We don't know how we're going to do that yet, but let's do it together. Let's work together toward that more hopeful, positive stance.
I love it. You've just triggered something in me there. When you were talking about when people are sharing story, that others, there's a relatability for others. Maybe if you could share a little bit about that, that the importance of that, because I get a sense with that. I see it happen when I do some work with people, and I get them to share what I call a stop story or a go story, and particularly in the stop story, which is about something that holds them back or whatever it might be. When they're telling that, other people in the room, you can see them. They're like,
"Yeah,
that's me." But I've also got another story. But I've also got that one and that one and that one. Talk a little bit about the importance of relatability and how that helps people work better together, perhaps.
Well, you know, I've seen it many times in groups. And first of all, you have to be aware of the level of toxicity in the room. So if you've got a situation where things are super toxic, maybe you need to work more individually with people before you put them together in a room. Another way I can get around this sometimes is by having people do pair work and then sharing in the bigger group. But even in teams that have been working together for a long time, people who've been in the same company for a decade or longer and know each other fairly well, suddenly when they start telling some of these stories, they see each other differently. They have a different lens into the person's life. And you can really see that. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't know so-and-so had a sense of humor, or I didn't know so-and-so loved to play tennis. I love to play tennis too. I mean, whatever it is, we see each other as more complete human beings.
Yeah. Knowing each other and seeing each other, that's pretty profound. That sounds like the step from the, how was your weekend? Yeah, pretty good. How was yours? Yeah, okay, let's get on with the business versus let's spend a bit of time to, what did you do on the weekend? And, you know, what have we got in common? If only we took more time in doing this work. Why do you think organizations, because I agree with what you said before, many haven't embraced it.
No.
Why do you think organizations shy away from this type of work?
I don't think they see the value. I don't think they understand the value of it. You know, and I'm sitting here in France and I still think often the idea of storytelling, and even in French, when people say, c'est du storytelling, that means, oh, that's bullshit, that's lies, right? So I don't think they understand the value of it. I think they think about it in terms of marketing or in terms of PR, in terms of, again, that story mask that we get to hide behind, like what we want the world to see of us, and then behind the scenes, you know, whatever happens, happens. And I am definitely not the person for that kind of work. So, you know, when I try to talk to those people, what I say makes no sense. At the same time, there are plenty of people who know that there's something missing. They've tried everything else. They've tried all the, you know, leadership trainings and this and that and, you know, team buildings and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes when they hear me talk, something kind of sparks. And they don't fully understand what I'm talking about yet. Because, like I said, we're so immersed in story. It's like the air we breathe. And we don't see it. It's invisible to us. So, you know, my first job is to kind of help people become aware of it.
Yeah. And given the amount of experiences in our lives, is there any research on how many stories we actually carry, we have stored away somewhere in our minds, in our hearts, in our guts, whatever it might be?
Honestly, I think we can trigger stories with anything. There's a really, really interesting abstract little 1 minute long film. It was an experiment, psychological experiment done in the 1940s by two scientists. It's called the Heider-Simmel experiment. And there's a square and there's some moving shapes. There are two circles and a triangle, I think, or it's two triangles and a circle, I forget. And they move around this environment and they go into the rectangular shape. They go in, it's like open and they can go in and out. They go in and they go out and they run around the outside of the shape. And I show that frequently to clients or to students especially, and everybody creates a story. We project a story onto it. Either we're seeing a situation of an abusive family relationship, we're seeing a love triangle, we're seeing violence, we're seeing motivation, we're seeing jealousy, we're seeing bullying on the playground, and we have a story like that in a minute.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people who tell me that they don't see a story, but I don't always really believe them, right? You know, the ones who try, like, well, there's a triangle and there's a circle and the triangle moves this way and that way. And then somewhere in the telling of it, a story element will pop up and I'm like, there, it's there. You know?
Do you think is that like a denial thing? Because it's funny, in the work I do, this human work, people say, we'll get to the human work when we've done the real work. In the workplace, is there a bit of that with story as well, that's not really work, it's sort of voodoo fun stuff?
it's a way to take a break or something. And you know, it's wonderful to hear each other's stories and to connect, but that's not our work. Yeah.
I'm with you with everything you've been saying about, even when you said people don't quite understand what I do, but they get the sense I live in that world every day. They're like, what's the ROI going to be? And I'm like, I don't know. It depends on how much effort you put into it is what you're going to take out of it. So that's interesting. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about, I picked it up before when you said it, this idea that the hardest story for us to tell is the story of self.
Is our own story.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd be fascinated to hear something around that.
We all have the experience of, we see in a loved one or in a friend or in a colleague, you know, a behavior or a way of being that isn't suiting them, and we can spot it right away, or we can spot their talents right away. And we know that they're blind to it themselves, right? There are aspects that we see about them that they don't see. And so it's really easy for us from the outside to say, if you just changed your narrative in this way, you know, if you just believed in yourself more, if you just, then, you know, everything would fall into place. For ourselves, we're inside of it. It's like the air we breathe of who we are. And it's really hard sometimes to look back over an entire lifetime and tease out the elements that have influenced us until now, for example. It's also really hard to not listen to our internal stories that are saying us, yeah, but, you know, I've done an exercise with clients very often where I do their negative resume. So I'm like, all right, just if you, people who feel imposter syndrome, right? I say, okay, write me your, I have your proper resume. Here it is. Write me your negative resume. Write me all your failures. And as they're writing their failures, what I see is sometimes they're just factual. You know, I didn't get into the school I wanted to get into, but a lot of the times they're emotional. A musician who doesn't practice enough, well, define enough, what does that mean?
You know?
And then we put it side by side with the actual resume. And I have them circle what are the facts. I didn't get into my top school choice, but I did get, you know, I didn't get into Harvard, but I got into Yale or something equally impressive. And okay, so here are all the facts. And you as a storyteller have the right at any given moment to choose which facts you want to present to somebody else. And does somebody else really need to know you didn't get into your top school? Or is that even important? And they can begin to parse that. They can begin to see that both stories are legitimate, but you're the storyteller and you get to choose in any given moment what story you want to tell. And if you want to tell the story about how you didn't get into Harvard because it's no longer a wound, it's a scar, and now you can talk about it and share it with other people in a way that's useful to them, go for it. But if all you're telling me by saying that is a story of your insecurity, then that's a story that needs a little bit of work.
Yes, right? I like it. And I'm sure you see all sorts of things when working with people, because humans are different. We all have different experiences and different backgrounds, whatever it might have been. So I'm sure you come across some amazing things there. I want to go on to now, just as someone who's an expert in this area and obviously very passionate about it with the work that you do, if you're talking to a manager around, and it could be about them unpacking their own story or being able to use narrative in order to mobilize people, inspire people, whatever it might be, what would be three simple and practical tips you could give to really start to become better at this, more comfortable with it, more expert at it?
So if we're talking specifically now, managers who really want to lead other people, there are several things that they can do. But I think one is to really listen to people's stories. But first of all, your own. Really, first of all, dig into and notice those internal stories that you're telling yourself and get familiar with them. And notice when you're in the should be doing mode versus the what I want to be doing or who I really am mode. And, you know, when I say what I want to be doing, I'm not talking about like lying on a beach in Bali. I'm talking about in the moment, who do I want to be? Who do I think I should be? But who do I really want to be in this moment?
Yeah.
That's hugely important. So get to know your own stories, get to know your own whys, learn how to talk about them and learn how to understand them.
Just quickly on that one, why is that such an important first step?
Because we're always trying to impose change on other people, or we're always trying to achieve our goals by getting other people or things outside of us to change, be it people or a situation or something else. And we neglect ourselves.
Yeah.
And we are part of the system.
Yeah, this is interesting because COVID's, when you talk about imposing change, change was always being imposed by someone. What's going on at the moment is affecting everyone. Mm-hmm. So whether you're a manager, a CEO, or whether you're on the shop floor or whatever, everyone is impacted in some way. So I guess people who would invest the time in knowing themselves would potentially be coping a bit better through some of what's going on now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because getting to know yourself better means coming to terms with uncertainty. And if you've come to terms with uncertainty, this isn't easy for any of us, but it's easier.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
And there's something there around identity as well. Like I think that
absolutely.
If your identity is I'm this and this is what I'm known as and this is, but all of a sudden I'm not there anymore because I'm working from home or whatever it is, it's like people can lose their way if they don't have a good sense of self, can't they?
Absolutely. And ultimately, every story is a story of identity.
Yep.
Who are we in the world? Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going?
Yep. Yeah. What am I known for? Yeah. Interesting. What about a second thing, Alexis? What would be the second thing for managers or just anyone to be considering here?
Okay. So we talked about listening to your own stories, but then there's really listening to another person's stories and to understanding the importance of accepting that story as true for that person in that moment. And to try to understand that beneath that story are human hopes and fears. And to really connect with that and really be able to stay with that. And that takes some courage because you might end up hearing something that you don't agree with or that counters your own story or that's going to make what you want to get done seem more difficult because now you're faced with somebody who is showing cynicism or resistance or something like that. So the tendency there is to want to argue and impose your story and say why yours is better or to try to fix their mindset. And, you know, but if you're really doing the work of narrative intelligence, you're going to get curious instead and you're going to ask questions and you're going to really try to see the wisdom in that person's story because it is there. There is wisdom in a person's story. It may be buried because they may be wearing layers of story mask, but whatever it is they're communicating, it touches on a deeper need. So the more you can stay with a story and listen and ask questions, the closer you'll get to that emotional truth of what it is that they're saying. And you may find a way to shift the conversation or you may feel really stuck and come to an impasse, but that doesn't really matter in that moment because you can always say, okay, I've heard you. Let's step away. Let me digest and let's come back and continue talking. And that person is going to feel respected. They're going to feel that you really took the time to listen, that you really tried to understand their point of view. So they're going to feel heard and seen. And, you know, that is a huge gift. And receiving somebody's story is an honor and not trying to change it is really a gift that you're giving them.
Yeah. I love the idea of curiosity. And the thing that I'll put on the other end of that is this crazy notion that we can try to convince others of our rightness. So that I'm right. And so if I'm right, I guess that's going to put the screen up straight away and I'm not going to hear the story because I'm already in myself thinking I'm right. So, yeah, I like that. And a third one?
And a third one, if you really want to start practicing this, and I think it's relatively safe, again, check for the toxicity in your team or in the room or invite people that you feel safe with, but just start asking people to share their stories of lived experiences. Don't ask them to go off and like make up a fictional story that they come and share, but just their lived experiences. And I've had people tell stories around, like in the Drinking Dialogues game, we told stories about our names. Yep. You know, tell a story about your name. What does your name mean to you? Do you like it? How'd you get it? Who named you? You know, or I've had them tell stories about their hometowns. I've had a group of people who work in the aromatic industry tell stories about their favorite scents. And that was interesting because, you know, they've been working together for a very long time and they've never thought to ask that question of each other, you know. I've had people tell stories about their shoes. I mean, it can be about anything. And you'll see that people will find a story. And then you'll see the energy shift in the room, like we talked about before. Mm. Stories trigger chemicals in our brains. They release dopamine and oxytocin and endorphins, and that makes us curious and makes us feel bonded and connected, and it helps us relax. And you'll see that, and you'll see there the power of story.
Yeah, I love that. Practice. It's interesting, like setting aside time to practice sharing story. I think if people are listening to this and they have their back-to-back meetings, what if they said, why don't we put 10 to 15 minutes in this one-hour meeting of just sharing story? That energy that you just talked about could help them to do much better other work that they've got to do. I love that. Thank you. Nothing like practicing things. Simplicity and complexity. So I have a view around this. It's not always the view that my guests hold, but I have this view that we try and overcomplicate things. And what I will say is sometimes the most simple stories, I think, are the most powerful stories. Why is it that if you do think this, and you don't have to think this, why is it you think that humans try and overcomplicate stuff,
right,
go for complexity when maybe simplicity is not a bad place to go?
Right. I see what you mean. And I also do think that there are times when we oversimplify or, you know, so both happen. And I think ultimately, because we are creatures of hope and fear, and that's pretty much my answer to everything. That's my very simple answer to everything. We are creatures of hope and fear. And we complicate things because we're scared, and we avoid simplicity because we're scared. And, you know, in our society, simplicity doesn't signal expertise as well as complexity. If I can understand you too easily, if I get what you're talking about, then maybe what you're offering is too simplistic, which is different from simple, right?
Yes.
And it won't solve my problems. So I think it takes tremendous courage to be simple. Mm-hmm. It takes that self-knowledge, I think, to be simple. And I can give you an example because my laboratory is me. You know, my research is basically me. I'm like, I check in, I meditate, so I check in, and I'm like, what's happening inside? And every month I write a newsletter on narrative intelligence for leaders, in which I tell personal stories and make what I think are simple points. And every month it's a huge struggle for me. Because in my mind, the stories inside are like, well, who's going to read this? Who's going to care? Is it speaking to their business needs? How will leaders understand what I'm talking about? Do I even know what their needs are? And who am I to tell them anything about leadership? And at the same time, there's another voice that keeps saying, leaders are people too. They have hopes and fears, you know? Trust your instincts. They need stories, right? See what happens. You're modeling the behavior you want them to step into, you know?
Yeah, I love it.
But I have to get myself out of their way every single month. It's a real struggle. It takes me, like, I procrastinate, and it takes me a long time to get this thing out the door.
I'm with you because I've just put my monthly newsletter out this week, and it always just gets triggered in the last week before I'm supposed to do it. And I'm like, I better start thinking of something to write because people are expecting to see something. And then I'm a bit like you. Well, what are they going to be interested in? Are they really going to be interested in, I've been locked down for 6 months pretty heavily, and then you just write it. And then someone comes back and goes, that's really on brand for you. That's, we expect to see that stuff about you. And we know more about you. So even someone who is an expert at storytelling, which I really like your openness and vulnerability, is you struggle with it as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There is hope then for the plumber with the leaky tap at home as well, I always say.
Yeah. And story isn't like a soft and fuzzy thing. It's a really rigorous, robust thing. And, you know, to get back to this idea of the power of storytelling, it has the power to be destructive and manipulative. And that's another reason why we need to increase our narrative intelligence, because it helps us see those stories coming and not be manipulated.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about this hope and fear piece?
Yes, I can.
Please, please do. go for it. We've got plenty of time. Talk about why that's so important to understand.
Because I'll just give you an example. At every moment of every day, we have hope and fear. We just need to check in and we will find it. Right. So right now, obviously, I'm hoping the podcast will go well. We're almost at the end. I think, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about it. But there was a fear in the beginning that my microphone might act up because it was buzzing on me yesterday. So, you know, then there was a story that was generated. I'm going to ruin the podcast. We might have to redo it. Mark's going to get annoyed. You know, it's not a big deal. It's like, yeah. Again, a little anxiety, not a big deal, but it's there. Right. And I'm sure if I ask you, what hope and fears are you experiencing right now as we sit here?
I can tell you one right now is I use two streams to record this via Zoom. And then I use a thing called GarageBand. And I just saw a note flick up that says, GarageBand has been disconnected. So I'm like, well, the Zoom thing will still work. And my editor, Andy, he'll be fine. He'll be able to work with it. But I saw that come up and I'm like, my fear is that it doesn't work. And then I've got to send you an email that says, hey, Alexis, have you got another hour spare somewhere? So that's a fear. My hope was that we'd have a really interesting conversation. And I'm hopeful that that's what's been going on. So absolutely.
Yeah. So we can tap in and find those hopes and fears at any moment. And ultimately, if we really distill them back, what those hopes and fears are about are the fact that we're mortal. So we hope we're going to wake up to see another day tomorrow. On some level, we fear that we won't. Mm-hmm. It's existential. It's life and death. And if it's not literal life and death, it's symbolic life and death. We hope that we're going to be accepted, included, loved. We'll have that sense of belonging, or we fear that we're going to be excluded, shunned, banished, abandoned.
Yep.
And that's at the core of our stories. Any movie you've ever watched, any novel you've ever read, it's about a protagonist, their goals, their hope of achieving those goals, and their fears and the obstacles that get in the way from achieving those goals.
Yeah. It's led me on to another question because it's such a great thing to delve into is that let's go back to the workplace for a minute. What's potentially the fear for people if they start to tap into story in the workplace? What would be a fear, a common fear for people?
That they might share just by going into the story work itself?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, self-revelation.
Mm.
That is self-revelation. Will I be accepted for who I really am?
Yeah.
Again, it's that who I think I should be, who I really am. And we at work, we are who we think we should be.
Yes.
There are very few places where we can show up as who we are.
Even though organizations do say, we would like you to bring your whole self to work, we very rarely see that. I think that's fascinating that, and a great tip again for people listening, that how do you create that space for people to step into who they really are? Because I think that's when the great work happens.
And then there's another aspect to that, which means bringing your whole self to work doesn't mean letting it all hang out.
No.
It means owning all of who you are. And then like the negative resume, choosing what aspects you want to activate in that moment.
Yeah.
But you're doing it from a place of connectedness and integrity in yourself. And you have a very different experience. You still might not want to share everything about your personal life with your colleagues. No one says you have to. Mm. But you're not feeling like you have to hide it either. If you wanted to, you could choose to.
How do you help managers to read the room so that they know? Like some managers, I get a sense, I know with my work, people get really excited and they just want everyone to get excited.
Oh, God, I hate that. Oh, I hate that.
How do you help to regulate the overexcited manager who thinks that they've told their story and they've divulged everything to the world, so now it's your turn?
Well, I mean, I think there are two aspects to that. One is putting too much importance on a certain kind of energy like that. It's the energy that's going to get people motivated. And I don't believe that. I'm not a kind of person who responds to that positively. In fact, it turns me off. Some people respond and some people don't. So it shouldn't be your only tool in your toolbox. If you are that kind of person naturally, you're going to bring that energy into the room differently. But if you're manufacturing it and you're trying to manufacture it in others, that's just not okay. That's the first aspect. The second aspect is to really become conscious that there are clashing narratives in this world. That when you tell your story, you're putting it into the existing story soup of all these clashing narratives. So it's like you're adding a flavor to the soup, and telling it once isn't adding enough flavor. It's going to disappear in the soup. So I can, you know, if I give you an example, I'll take an example from the business world of let's say there's a law firm that wants to encourage more of its lawyers to volunteer pro bono hours. So they create these really wonderful, well-produced videos that showcase the stories of the people that their lawyers are helping, you know, these social justice cases and these, you know, helping these economically disadvantaged people in the third world and, you know, all this do-gooder stuff, right? And it lands like a fly in the soup, right? You know, nobody wants the story.
Yeah.
Why? Because there are clashing narratives behind it. There is a narrative in the law firm that says, if you're spending your time doing pro bono hours, you're not billing enough and you're not taking your career seriously. So that's an unspoken narrative, but it's an enacted one. Everybody knows that it's real. Yeah. And then you've got the lawyers themselves who are like, I'm overworked as it is. I'm stressed. I never see my kids. My wife is about to leave me. I would love to be able to give back, but I cannot. And these videos now are making me feel guilty. And now I'm mad. So you can push that story and you're just going to piss people off. Or you can look at it and go, okay, how serious are we about our pro bono program? Do we really want to up it? Well, then we got to talk, you know, get the senior partners on board. Or are we actually okay with where it is? And then we can just stop bludgeoning people with a story that nobody wants.
Lovely. And finally, before I get you to share some details where people can find you, one thing I hear a bit in the room is like someone gets up and tells their stop story, and then all of a sudden everyone else's faces are like, they're looking at the ground and you look up and they're like, I'm not going next because my story's not as good as that one.
Right.
Story as a competition pisses me off. It's not a competition, is it?
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. And I teach screenwriting at a college here to freshmen in college. So, you know, young 18-year-olds who are afraid of writing.
Yep.
And where not everybody's mother tongue is English either, and they're writing in English. So I really have to convince them that I'm not looking for perfection. I'm looking for you to explore and tell your stories. And it's not about, I'm not comparing you to anybody else. It's about the skills that I'm offering and how you're implementing them and how you're growing yourself as a storyteller and narrator. And I have to just, every class, insist on this and create a space where they can hear each other's stories, but where they can give each other feedback in a very safe way. And, you know, that's an internal also story of lack of confidence. So what I have to say isn't going to be as good as what somebody else just said. And it's never true. It's just never true. People always have something really fascinating to share.
Giving them that space to do it is a wonderful thing to be able to do. Let's finish up on where people can find you, because you mentioned you've got a newsletter. So I'm thinking we could subscribe to that on your website or something. Would that be the place to go? So where do they go to?
It's storynova.com, storynova.com. And the other place is LinkedIn. I don't really hang out anywhere else on social media. And I do offer coaching and I have workshops and things like that, online classes. So if anybody's interested in that, they can always email me either through the website or at welcome@storynova.com. And I'm pretty accessible in, you know, that way.
Well, particularly we are all these days, we're doing work in the room versus doing work virtually now. It's, I don't know, are you back out working in organizations face-to-face? And
I haven't been in an organization, but at the school, I go into the school.
Nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
So live those days again. Alexis, thanks for coming on. You can live in absolute hope here and not fear. This has been brilliant. You've shared so many wonderful things and I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Just a couple of things that I picked up from that: incredible insights and expertise and just the ability for Alexis to share story and put herself into that vulnerable space as well. This idea of story shielding, how we use numbers and data and things like that, which is important at times, but not to use them as a story shield, was really interesting. That story is invitational, that we are inviting as an invitation to listen to story, but also to share story. And it's something that being able to listen to someone else's story, as Alexis said, is a gift. And it's a gift that we should really appreciate, that we have the opportunity to hear from others, to sit with listening and being present and aware of their story, not trying to correct it or convince others of our rightness, I think, were some really interesting things that come up. This idea of hope and fear, that what humans are is really hope and fear. And, you know, the really simple example that she used around the podcast, hoping
that her microphone was going to work when, in fact, one of my apps that I use actually halfway through shit itself. So interestingly, I wasn't fearing that that would happen, but when it did happen, I did have a very, very quick feeling of I am hoping that the other one is working. I'm fearing that they've both gone out, but I think I'm going to be right there. Listening to your own story, starting itself, really important. Listening to others' stories. And I guess that last tip, and this goes for everything we do in life, is you've got to practice this. So I really, really implore people who have the opportunity, why don't you set up some time with your team, maybe with your family, just set up some time where you can actually sit around and you can offer the opportunity for people to share story. Such a great episode. If you liked it, why not share it with your friends? And if you loved it, rate it 5 stars. But until next time, let's keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.